Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The school year marks the fourth navigating COVID-19, and a lot has changed since spring of 2020, but challenges continue to evolve. While some resources are expanding, like transitional kindergarten and after-school programs, others are becoming further strained, such as school staff and the overall mental health of students and adults. And these changes can vary from one school district to the next. Diana Lambert is a senior reporter with EdSource and spoke with school districts large and small across California and joins us with the big themes for the 2022-2023 school year. Good morning, Diana. Welcome back.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
So after speaking with districts across the state, from Los Angeles Unified to Oroville, Sac City Unified, even charter schools in the Bay Area, what stands out to you about how districts are approaching this school year?
Well, actually, districts are approaching this school year with a great deal of optimism. They actually think they have a lot more experience dealing with COVID protocols and student behavior this year, and they expect it to be a better year all around for students and teachers.
What are the biggest changes when it comes to COVID protocols?
Mainly that they're going away. I mean, masking has all but gone away. A couple of schools still have it. There's no social distancing. Testing has changed. The state no longer requires students to be tested if they've had close contact with other people who have been infected. And mostly schools are just sending home tests that students can take when COVID levels are high or when they're coming back from a school break.
When it comes to vaccines, are there any mandates for students or staff that you were able to gather from school districts?
No, pretty much every single school district that had a mandatory vaccination requirement has dropped it, or at least has it on hold. I believe at Sac City Unified, it's on hold. And the state overall has decided to put it on hold to at least July of 2023.
What was the rationale from that, especially from the state holding off until 2023?
They've decided they're going to wait till it's fully approved by the FDA before they proceed, and then they'll make a decision at that time.
I would imagine if you were talking to parents, you know, there's still kind of that issue of not being able to make everyone feel comfortable, because I would imagine there are some parents who would prefer masking while others wouldn't.
Absolutely. I mean, there are parents on both sides of this. And in California, a lot of parents would prefer masking so they can send their kids to school with masks, and they are not allowed to be told not to wear them. And students are supposed to treat everyone with respect, no matter whether they mask or don't mask.
We also have another contagious virus. I'm curious what conversations are taking place surrounding monkeypox or mpox for a virus that spreads through close skin-to-skin contact as well as contaminated materials.
Well, they really are concerned about monkeypox, although we know that not many children have had monkeypox, I think less than six. However, it does spread by close contact, and kids do horse around, they do wrestle, they do gymnastics. So they're disinfecting all the mats they use in athletics, and they're just using their regular protocols. Whenever there's an infectious disease, if you see someone with an outbreak, they're to be excluded from school.
Did you talk to an infectious disease physician about monkeypox and their level of concern now that school's going back into session?
I did, and there was a low level of concern, actually. They said teachers shouldn't be concerned, that if schools follow procedures already in place for infectious diseases, that there is no reason to have any extra concern about monkeypox.
I'm also curious about the mental health of students. What are districts going to be doing to put a greater emphasis on mental health this school year?
They said they're going to put even a greater emphasis than last year on social emotional health. And now that the governor has released, I believe it's $4 billion for counselors, they are going to be adding counselors, adding psychologists to their campuses. Is that they said they're really going to focus on social emotional health because now they don't have to focus on COVID so much this year.
Is there still hybrid learning or is it for the most part, everything's back in person?
For the most part, everything is back in person. Yeah.
There's also adults, teachers, and school staff. What about their mental health?
That's a big concern. A lot of teachers last year, I should say a lot, some teachers last year quit because they felt student behavior was so bad. They felt very pressured. They were under a lot of stress. So they quit. So there's a lot of concern about that and adding social emotional supports for teachers. I don't see that that's being widely done yet, but hopefully they'll be added this year.
But there's an awareness of it.
There's definitely an awareness of it.
How are staffing shortages? I mean, that has been a longstanding issue. And what I'm hearing from you is some people actually left their line of work because of the challenges from last year.
They did. And staffing shortages this year, it's not clear yet. We won't see numbers for a while. They seem to be slightly better in the, as far as teachers are concerned. And I think that's just because of ramped up recruitment and a lot of bonuses added and more people going through the teacher preparation program. However, we are having a lot more staffing issues with classified staff, the bus drivers, the paraprofessionals, the different people who help in the school that aren't credentialed teachers.
Yeah, you actually spoke with Oroville about this. How are they navigating a shortage of bus drivers?
They're doing everything they can. They're getting rid of the buses and using vans instead, because you only need a Class B license or Class C license for a van. So they're getting just everyday people to come drive vans to get kids to school. That means like 10 kids in a van instead of 50 or 80.
And that probably has like ripple effects for even just outside of school, but at school activities and athletics as well.
Absolutely. So they've had to cancel a lot of their trips. They weren't able to go to the finals last year because they couldn't get the buses together, or they had to have parents drive. Sorry. But yeah, it really does impact extracurricular activities.
Yeah. There are some new additions and expansion of programs, because there's a record amount of state funding for K-12 education, not to mention some federal COVID relief as well. What are the big expansions and changes in terms of programs offered to students?
Well, universal kindergarten. This is the first year of universal kindergarten, which is the expansion of transitional kindergarten, which means we have more four-year-olds on campuses these days. They're going to start if between September 2nd and February 2nd, if you turn five, you get to go to school now. And in three more years, every four-year-old will be able to go to school.
Have some districts already gotten a head start?
They have.
What have you learned from them?
A lot of school districts are moving ahead with that. They said it's working really well. Parents are really receptive. They just generally have to get the word out to them, and then they come in. So they've expanded greatly. San Diego Unified has expanded greatly. They've been doing this for a while. So, and it's helping schools, because enrollment declines are really hurting schools financially, because you get paid per student for their daily attendance. And now by adding more four-year-olds, this helps them with their funding.
If enrollment has been going down, where are those students going?
A lot of it's just birth rate. Our birth rate's gone down, so naturally it's just going down. Some people are leaving the state. But it's mostly birth rate. Mm.
There's also the expansion of community schools. Can you explain what exactly those will do for the community?
Well, community school is meant to connect families with government and community services, and to offer parents a greater role in governing the school, so they have more input about what programs are going to be going on in the school, and the school boards generally allow them some concessions, some flexibility.
Oh, Diana, your mic went out. We'll get you back in just a second. You are listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with journalist Diana Lambert with EdSource about some of the biggest changes for back to school. Diana spoke with school districts across California, from large ones like Los Angeles Unified to smaller, more rural ones up in Oroville, as well as districts across Sacramento. Diana, do we have you back?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Okay. Getting back to community schools, because this seems like something that is it's a newer endeavor for the state. So what exactly will that accomplish?
Well, community schools, will connect parents with social services, mental health care, anything they may need. So generally, those are in the more lower income neighborhoods. And also allows parents a greater role in governing their schools, so they have more input with the programs that go on in the schools.
So cultivating maybe more of a trusting relationship?
That's exactly the idea.
There's another change as well. Aren't there later start times for some students? Will this potentially complicate or even arguably help the school year? I mean, it seems like that could be a complication.
Yes, it can really be for parents who have, you know, acclimated themselves to getting their kids to school at a certain time. But yeah, it's 8 a.m. for middle school and no earlier than 8:30 a.m. for high school students. The other complication is we have a severe bus driver shortage, and some districts are having a hard time recalculating their bus routes so that they get the kids to school at the right time. And now this complicates things further.
Mm. What was the rationale for later start times for some students?
The rationale are that high school students are greatly sleep deprived. They often can't fall asleep till later at night.
and that getting up too early is bad for them. It's bad for their health. It's bad for their ability to do well in school. Mm.
What's the main message that you're hearing from families this school year?
I think families are optimistic as well. They're just really happy to be back, happy to see things more normal. There's a lot of programming. Some people don't like the early start times. Parents don't like that in general. But mostly they're just really happy to be back in school.
What about from teachers and school staff as well?
Like I said, teachers are optimistic this year. They're hoping this will be a better year for them. They are really concerned last year with student behavior because a lot of students came back to school ill-prepared to be in a classroom environment, and it caused them to be disruptive in class. So this year, it seems that everyone's better acclimated to school. Mm.
Finally, what are you going to be keeping tabs on for the remainder of the school year?
Oh, everything for sure. But we are launching a big literacy program project, and we're looking at reading and how it's taught. So that's really where we're focusing next.
Diana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Diana Lambert is a senior reporter with EdSource and spoke with school districts large and small across the state and talked to us about the big themes for the 2022-2023 school year. Up next, conservatorships are under increasing scrutiny and spotlight. An ongoing investigation hones in on some of the most vulnerable adults with developmental disabilities. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Conservatorships have been catapulted into the national spotlight after Britney Spears' public battle to control her own finances, medical decisions, and personal life. But it also revealed to many a little-known or understood legal process impacting over 1 million Americans and thousands of Californians every year. An investigative journalist decided to dig deeper into this issue, and over the span of 2 years, zeroed in on the California Department of Developmental Services, or DDS, and their role in limited conservatorships over some of the most vulnerable Californians, adults with developmental disabilities. Joining us now is Andy Judson, investigative reporter for ABC 10 in Sacramento, to share her latest docuseries, The Price of Care, Taken by the State. She's also joined by Thomas Coleman, the legal director of the Spectrum Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to conservatorship reform. Andy and Thomas, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicki. Thank you for having us.
Well, Andy, starting with you, we had you on Insight last year to discuss conservatorships, and you looked into the systemic issues and what's being done or not being done to regulate a powerful industry in California. Just remind us, what is the intention of a conservatorship?
Yeah, the overall intention of a conservatorship is to take someone, probably a more vulnerable person, often the elderly or someone with a disability, and take away their rights and give them to another person who can take care of them, in short.
Yeah. Last year, you focused largely on the elderly and also the potential for emotional and financial abuse under some conservatorships. But now you're really honing in on adults with developmental disabilities. What led you down this path?
Yeah, I think, you know, we all know we learned about conservatorships because of Britney Spears. What I think a lot of people don't understand is that there's different types of conservatorships in California. There's three main ones. There's general, which is what we focused on for the elderly. There's an LPS conservatorship, which is for mentally unwell patients, where 5150 holds usually spark that type of conservatorship. And then there's limited, which is the ones we're focusing on in this investigation, which is for those with disabilities. And I think it's important to note that most people under limited conservatorships are placed under them at age 18. So it's a conservatorship really for their entire life. So digging into this different type of conservatorship, we heard feedback from our initial investigation. It's like, hey, great job. You didn't cover this other kind. So we're like, all right, here we go. Let's try it out.
Why is it called limited conservatorship? What makes it limited?
Yeah, there's seven specific powers that it's supposed to be limited because it doesn't strip someone completely of all of their rights, like general conservatorship. So these seven powers include, you know, medical decisions. One is marriage. One is who, you know, you have social contacts with. So it's supposed to, you know, specify what someone is able and able not to make decisions on. And they'll take that right from them and give it to, you know, a parent or someone else who then, you know, is in a better position to make those specific decisions for that person.
How many people are we talking about in California that are under a limited conservatorship?
Yeah, Tom might be able to answer that one a little bit better, but it is, you know, thousands and thousands of people under these types of conservatorships.
Yeah, Tom, I'll bring you in. How many people are under a limited conservatorship in California?
Well, no one really knows for sure, but according to the records of the Department of Developmental Services, they're admitting to 57,000 adults with developmental disabilities being under a conservatorship. So that's a good starting point. But the courts themselves, they're supposed to be doing the protecting, and the judicial branch of government doesn't have a clue as to how many people they're protecting. That's how little they care about this issue.
Given that this falls under a state agency, Tom, why isn't there better tracking for this?
Well, basically, except when the Department of Developmental Services is where the director is appointed to be a conservator of an individual, which only has occurred in about 450 cases approximately, the other 56,000 people, the department just washes its hands of it. It does not have any program for monitoring the regional centers. The regional centers play a role in all of these cases. They're supposed to do an assessment of the individual's capacities and inabilities and so on. It's an unfunded legislative mandate. There's nothing in their budget. There's nothing in their contracts. There's no training. There's no monitoring. So basically, DDS doesn't want to get involved, and they've been doing a really good job of not being involved. But as a result, it's just a free-for-all that every regional center does what it wants, every judge does what he or she wants, and there's just no rhyme or reason. When I look at this particular case of Garth Shute, that was the first episode, and when I heard the court-appointed attorney saying, well, I didn't know that he wanted to stay with his mother and be at home, I just almost fell off my chair. I mean, what type of an attorney is not going to listen to the client? And in that program, it showed that he told the judge, he told ABC 10, he told the police, he told five separate occasions, and yet his court-appointed attorney did not advocate for his rights. So that is a huge problem with the system.
Well, let's actually get into that because the first episode, it focuses on the Shute family in Sacramento. And as Tom was mentioning, the family member is named Garth. He's 40 years old. He has a developmental disability. He needs a caretaker. How did you find this family?
Yeah, actually, this is our, as you mentioned, second season of digging into conservatorships. And they actually watched the first season about general conservatorships, and they didn't know that we had actually started to look into limited conservatorships. So they reached out to us, and it was just really good timing. And we just dug in and went from there.
What did you learn from the Shute family when learning about this other type of conservatorship in the state?
Yeah, you know, I think I'll start off with what stood out to me maybe more, because when we sat down for the interview, I think when Jill, the mother, was talking, I was thinking, you know, this really can't be real. This doesn't happen in the United States. But I think because we've been covering conservatorships for so long, we knew, you know, the court documents to look at. We knew who to talk to, and it is happening. So I think that that's what really stood out. And we learned that this is happening here. You know, people who are saying, this is what I want, are not being listened to.
Hmm. I mean, they had little to no contact or knowledge about Garth's whereabouts. You also tried to reach out to Garth as well, and initially to no avail, but you were able to connect with him. How were you able to make that happen?
Yeah, you know, we did try to go through his service coordinator for the regional center, who is acting as his conservator because he is conserved by DDS. They would not allow us to have an interview with Garth. They said that he has not expressed any interest in talking with us. I do want to specify, we then said, you know, was he explained to that, you know, a reporter wants to talk with him, and we never got a response. So, you know, I think for us, it was really important to ensure we reported exactly what Garth wants. So that's why we went to another level of trying to make sure we had contact with him. And his eldest brother, Russell, at that point is still allowed visitation. And so he hadn't seen Garth for about 6 months and was granted visitation at a local park. And him and his wife and their kids met with Garth. And so we, you know, viewed it from afar to just see what their interactions were. And about halfway through their visit, I had the opportunity to go up and talk with him.
Well, let's listen to a part of that conversation.
Do you miss your family?
Yes. My brother. I kind of do.
Do you wish you lived with your family, Garth?
Yes. I truly miss my mom.
Listen. Where would you like to live?
Where do you want to live, Garth?
With my family.
Yeah, with who specifically?
Mom.
And Andy, this wasn't the only time Garth had expressed wanting to live with his family. There was another incident when law enforcement responded to the home. Can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, so law enforcement, the sheriff's department, was called and did a welfare check on the family. If you watch the investigation, we explain exactly up to this point why this happened. But anyways, the deputies were there, and Ian, the one of the brothers, filmed the entirety of their check there, which was about 47 minutes. And during it, you know, they took Garth outside and asked him directly, you know, where do you want to live? He again, as you heard, said clear as day, I want to live with my mom. I want to live with my family. And that was reiterated throughout their visit there.
Yeah. And I mean, he's currently at a state funded care facility. You actually, this is a 2-year investigation, but just last month there was a court hearing for Garth about his conservatorship, and he spoke directly to the judge after his mother noticed that her son's hand was raised. So we're going to take a quick listen to what Garth said to the judge.
Garth has patiently been holding his hand up for almost 5 minutes, so hopefully we can address that.
Until this point, Garth has rarely had a voice in court.
You know this girl that tried to take my money and my justice?
Hey, Garth, what I want you to do is I want you to talk to Mr. Harpainter about your concerns, okay? And what you want to do.
So I want to live with my mom.
I'm sorry, I can't.
I'm saying I want to live with my mom.
And who is Mr. Harpainter?
Yeah, Mr. Harpainter is Garth's court-appointed attorney. So the court has appointed Harpainter as Garth's representative to uphold what Garth wants and, you know, represent that in a court of law.
Hmm. What has DDS said about this? I mean, this is a 2-year investigation.
That's a great question. We've been asking DDS, the Department of Developmental Services, for an on-camera interview throughout this for about 8 months now, and they've refused every time. And even before we aired, we did something I've actually never done in an investigation before. We sent them a 3-page single space letter outlining our investigation's findings and asking them 15 very specific questions of findings that we had found. And we did this because we wanted to make sure they understood what was coming out in our investigation and had, you know, a fair opportunity to respond and give their side. And they did respond, but it was with a pretty generic written statement, and it didn't answer any of our questions.
And the Department of Developmental Services actually released an update, what, a day or two before the first episode of your investigation aired?
Mm-hmm, yeah, 2 days right before our investigation aired, they released a press release with new actions saying they're going to be taking these actions to supposedly support those that are conserved under them. So we obviously thought the timing of this was really interesting. Some of those actions are forming a panel of national subject experts to complete a review. But none of these actions had specific details on, you know, budget or when these things will happen. So we requested an interview again with DDS, you know, a day before our investigation aired because we wanted to ask them about this. And they again declined.
What is the status of GARS situation? Where does it stand now?
Yeah, I mean, they have another hearing in December. And before then, the family, the judge ordered the family and DDS to meet and hopefully come to a resolution. Unfortunately, I don't have an update on that yet, but hopefully they can find that resolution.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with investigative reporter Andy Judson about her documentary series on conservatorships in California. Thomas, I want to bring you in. Tell us more about the Spectrum Institute and how it helps adults with mental or developmental disabilities.
Well, Spectrum Institute has been studying the conservatorship system in California for 10 years, and we just dug deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's a very complex system because it's decentralized. There's no one in charge of the system. So each county does its own thing, and each regional center does its own thing. So what we do is we try to bring to light the flaws in the system, which are many. Every moving part of the system is broken and in need of repair. And then we try to identify the solutions. What can be done to improve the situation for these tens of thousands of adults, and especially those who are not yet conserved? Every year there are 5,000 or more new petitions filed. And this is where the people need to have vigorous defense services. So we've offered legal training for public defenders and other defense attorneys, but they're not getting it. This example here in this case, this attorney should have been zealously advocating for his client's wishes. And as soon as this came up at the last hearing, the attorney should have done something immediately to file a motion to get him back with his family, not waiting till December, but arguing, you know, let's get some unmonitored visitation with the family members first, and then I'm going to be bringing motions to change this whole dynamic so he's back at home. So the Superior Court should be ashamed of the way it's operating its court-appointed attorney program, and I am surprised that the State Bar of California has not received a complaint against this attorney to investigate his performance in this case, because this is really where the pressure needs to be made. Also, the buck stops at the top with the governor and with the secretary of the Health and Human Services Agency and with the director of the Department of DDS. There needs to be more funding, and there needs to be performance standards and monitoring, not just of the 400 and some people that are under DDS, but all 57,000 of them and the way that the system is operating. So right now it's a free for all. And I think that people need to look to the governor, to the budget, to the, as they say, the Secretary of the Health and Human Services, the Mark Gahaly, and also Nancy Bargmann. So this is where the pressure points are for reform. The executive branch needs to improve.
How does California compare to adult guardianship in other states?
It's about the same. It's a mess everywhere. Some states have done better. Nevada is more of a model now because it had scandals and so on, but the judicial branch and the legislature got involved, passed laws, changed everything, and now people get a court-appointed attorney who's not a part of the system, but there's a nonprofit that advocates, and they have been successful in getting about 25% of the petitions dismissed. And those who have been stuck in guardianships, sometimes for years, they've been successful in getting 25% of them liberated. In California, once you're in, it's like quicksand, you almost never get out. So I would look to Nevada, the Nevada model reform here in California.
Is there anything that California does right when it comes to conservatorships? I know that there are multiple types in the state.
Well, actually, not really, except recently the legislature has finally, what it's doing right is it's finally starting to pass some laws. So it passed the one requiring the attorneys to give zealous advocacy. But we see that doesn't always work because look in this case, but at least now that's a legal requirement to advocate for the wishes of the person, not what somebody else thinks is in their best interest, but what they want. There's a law pending now that's going to pass this year that's going to require that less restrictive alternatives be seriously considered. And they're going to pour about $10 million in funding so that every single court has a self-help center to help families and these individuals find alternatives so they don't get stuck in the system to begin with. Then there's another bill that's probably going to pass this year. And for those who do get placed into conservatorship, it's going to require a very detailed continuing care plan about what must be done to protect this person's rights for visitation and health and everything. So what's the good news is the legislature is finally starting to pay attention. The bad news is the executive branch still is in denial, the governor and these agency heads, the secretaries. So, and the judiciary just doesn't want to talk about it at all because they're so used to just the railroad runs on time and the railroad always goes in one destination and makes it there. And efficiency is really what they're looking at. So the Chief Justice is leaving. We'll have a new Chief Justice next year. So maybe things will change in the judicial branch with a new Chief Justice.
As Andy mentioned, DDS announced immediate steps toward system improvements a day or two before her docuseries began airing. What did DDS, the Department of Developmental Services, get right with these changes?
Well, the fact that they're bringing in some outside people to look at it and that they're going to have some more transparency and that they want to have some, let's say, close look at some of the individual cases, not just the how the system is operating. So all of that is good. I'm pleased to see it happening. I guess better late than never. But I mean, a group of us met with them, their lawyers and others in their department in 2016. We told them this day was coming. This day of reckoning was coming. We warned them. We pleaded with them to do something. 6 years later, now only because all the dirty linen was going to be exposed by Andy Judson's wonderful reporting, they finally decided to do something. So better late than never, and the proof will be in what they really do. Another good thing that's happening is that some grand juries are finally starting to investigate and make reports. So the Alameda County Grand Jury did a months-long report about what was happening there. It kind of, it really pointed to many flaws in the system and made recommendations. So other grand juries I know are investigating this in other counties too. So really the good news is that more people are paying attention at all levels.
And Vicki, I think I also just wanted to add one more thing on to what Tom was talking about with DDS's new reforms that they're supposedly taking. I think it's important to note that the California State Auditor's Office has been conducting audits of DDS for the last decade. And their most recent audit came out in June, just a couple of months ago, and it just had some really concerning findings about DDS. But what really stood out to me is that many things the auditor's office named weren't actually new. They've told DDS these things that are broken in the past audits, and they even called it shocking that DDS hasn't fixed these things that the auditors told them were broken. So I'm saying that because I really hope these new incentives DDS just released about their own conservatorship program are actually going to happen. But I think we can see from the auditor's reports, DDS has said they'll fix things years ago, and that has not happened. So my question is, why can we trust DDS now?
You know, and Andy, this is the first episode of a five-part series, and we were talking about the Garth and the Schutte family. What can viewers expect in the upcoming episodes?
Yeah, obviously in the first episode, we dig into how DDS can be the conservator of a person themselves. But if you thought that that was wild, buckle your seatbelt, because we really dig into DDS failing people with disabilities as a whole across California, which is their job. We dig into that California Auditor's report and we dig into the money and a lot of conflicts of interest that we found.
Yeah, how is this funded?
It's funded through our own taxpayer dollars. They have a $12 billion budget, and it's paid for through taxpayers right here in California.
What do you want people to take away from this series? Because this is often a situation that you don't really understand until you're in the thick of it with a family member or a loved one.
That's a great question. I think a lot of the people I've talked to say they didn't know that this could happen. They didn't know this could happen to them. If you watch the first episode, Jill has an extensive background in helping people with disabilities. So, and her and her three sons work for the state in other departments. So I think if it could happen to them, it really can happen to anyone. So to be aware that, you know, this is not only happening, it can happen to you, but it's also funded by our own taxpayer dollars is important for people to know.
Andy Judson is an investigative reporter for ABC 10. Thank you, Andy.
Thanks for having me.
And Thomas Coleman is a legal director of the Spectrum Institute, a nonprofit organization dedicated to human rights and focused on conservatorship reform. Thanks, Tom, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Andy's five-part docuseries, The Price of Care, Taken by the State, looks at the state agency responsible for conservatorships of adults with developmental disabilities. Each episode will air Thursday evening through the month of September. We have a link on our Insight page. Still ahead, the World Butchers Challenge is coming to Sacramento. We'll learn how Team USA hopes to carve up the competition. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Olympics of Butchery will be held in Sacramento over Labor Day weekend. The World Butchers Challenge will be held at Golden One Center, and teams from across the world will display their skill and craftsmanship as they compete to be crowned the best in their craft. We're talking about close to 100 of the world's most skilled butchers from Canada, Brazil, Australia, Wales, Portugal, just to name a few. Danny Johnson is the co-owner and butcher at Taylor's Market in Sacramento and will be leading Team USA at the World Butchers Challenge this year. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, for those unfamiliar with Taylor's Market, share its history in Sacramento's Lamb Park neighborhood.
Taylor's Market started actually 60 years ago last week, August 12th.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What a milestone.
Yes, by Ed Schell, who was the butcher, and Roy Taylor, who's the namesake. I came aboard in 1983. And became part owner in 1987. We've always been a neighborhood grocery store, a corner grocery store, which you would find anywhere in the country. And they've kind of faded away, but we're still thriving.
Your career began there when you were like 19 years old. What drew you to butchery?
My grandfather used to have a ranch up in Ophir outside of Newcastle, and he would deliver fruit to the fruit sheds in Newcastle. And there was a butcher across the street, so I would go on the fruit delivery. And I would jump out of the truck and go hang out at the butcher shop, eat hot dogs and watch them cut up hogs, and tell anybody who would listen I was going to be a butcher. So it was either be a butcher or play pro baseball, but I'm a butcher.
And there's still a great deal of skill with being a butcher as well. Nearly 40 years later, you're now co-owner of Taylor's Market. How did you become involved in a global community of butchers?
So 2017, my wife and I were traveling in Europe. And I got an email asking me to be part of this butcher team they were putting together for the United States to compete in the World Butcher Challenge. I told my wife, no, I'm not going to do it. I'll let Paul, who's on our team, our vice captain, he's our meat manager. I said, let's let Paul do it. I'm too old for this. And she got a hold of my children, who are adults, and said, you know, your dad has an opportunity, but he doesn't want to do it. And everybody talked me into it. They're like, no, you'd be good for this. You need to do this. So that's kind of how it started.
So how would you describe the World Butchers Challenge now that it's going to be landing in Sacramento next week?
If you've seen the show Iron Chef on Food Network, it's kind of like Iron Chef on steroids.
So in terms of the competition, you're running against a clock, right?
Yes, we have 3 hours and 15 minutes to cut up a half hog, a half beef, a whole lamb, 5 chickens, make 3 gourmet sausages, and a retail-themed display.
That does not sound like a lot of time. How do you prepare for something like that?
We've been practicing. Well, we started practicing in 2019, and then COVID shut us down. But we've been practicing steadily once a month with our whole team at Taylor's since January.
This is the first time that this challenge is going to be in the United States, right?
Correct.
Yeah, what led to this moment and to Sacramento?
So when we went to Belfast, I approached Mike Testa from Visit Sac, and I said, hey, you know, this ties in with Farm to Fork. You think that we could pull this off? And he's like, yeah, he goes, let me give it some thought. So in between that giving it thought, I went to the mayor and secured a couple days from the city for the Golden One Center. And then I went back to Mike and said, hey, I got the Golden One Center for this event. And he's like, really? He goes, I guess it's on now. And so he kind of turned us loose and he trusted us to make a presentation to the World Council in Belfast.
Yeah, and how many countries are participating?
There'll be 13. Originally there was 16, but we lost 3 because of funding and COVID.
And there's going to be events leading up to, I mean, what really is like 2 days of competitions?
Yes. So on Wednesday, the 31st of August, it's called Butcher's Beer and Barbecue at Urban Roots. That's a ticketed event. Thursday, there's a press conference at the Golden One Center. I believe that's at like 10 o'clock in the morning. And then the junior and apprentice competitions are on Friday. And then the main event is Saturday. And then Sunday at Memorial Auditorium, there's a gala dinner. An awards dinner.
You know, given that you mentioned that Sacramento is obviously known as a farm to fork capital, what do you think when we're going to have butchers, you know, nearly 100 or so from all over the world come to Sacramento, what do you think they're going to take away from our area?
I think they're going to be pleasantly surprised at just the bounty of agricultural areas around us. You know, Sacramento, you know, it sits in the center and then you can go 10 minutes out of the city and you're right into farmland.
Mm. What do you still love about being a butcher now that you've been doing it for almost 40 years?
I just like getting people what they need and sometimes solving problems. You know, when they come in and they go, hey, man, I'm having this dinner, but the recipe calls for this, but I kind of want to mess with it a little bit.
Yeah. And your philosophy, I was reading a quote of yours. It's like a good butcher knows how to feed the animal, eat the animal, and everything that has to be done in between those two points.
Correct. Correct. I was lucky that I have an animal husbandry background growing up in Loomis. And if you would have asked me 20 years ago, if you had to know, be so breed specific and what the feeds, I would have said, nah, you don't need to know that. But the consumer's getting more educated and it's our responsibility to help educate them.
How many members are going to be part of Team USA?
So we have 6 people that are competing on the Saturday, the 3rd. We have a junior competitor from Iowa, and then we have 2 alternates, and then we have an IT guy.
Anyone else from Sacramento, or are they all kind of spanning across the country?
So it's Paul Karras and I from Sacramento. There's a gentleman named Daniel Skirpik from Southern California. There's Brian Butler from Austin, Texas, T.C. Turner from Utah, and Mitchell Willis from New York.
You know, when talking about you just mentioned the Young Butcher competition and then I think a Butcher Apprentice World Championship. When it came to the Young Butcher contestants, they have to be under 35 years of age. I would imagine the skill to become a butcher at your level takes decades and decades of work.
If you put your head down, I mean, you can be pretty proficient in about 2 to 3 years. But you know, I've been doing it almost 40 years, and I learn something all the time.
What do you like about this up-and-coming generation of butchers?
They're pretty passionate, and, you know, once we get someone and get them inspired, they see what we have been doing and our involvement with the World Butcher Challenge, and like, I want to do that someday, and that's exactly why we got involved.
Mm. What are you looking forward to most? Because it's been about 3 years. You know, the pandemic put it on pause.
I'm just looking forward to actually cutting the meat. That's going to be the easy part.
Are there certain types of meat that you like to cut over others?
My favorite is lamb. That was what, when I landed at Taylor's, I didn't have a very big background in lamb. I'd went to a meat cutting school, and it's always been a lamb store at Taylor's. So I like, and it's very meticulous. So lamb is, to me, when you can really shine as a butcher.
When it comes to butchery, has there been somewhat of, I mean, now that there's a World Butchers Challenge, and this is what has developed over the last decade or so, has there been kind of a revival or an evolution of this type of work and skill that y'all do?
Yeah, it's kind of come full circle. I mean, when I started, it was, you know, it was still breaking down whole animals and stuff, and then it kind of went away to that. I've been doing this long enough that I started before they started vacuum packing meat, and now it's kind of come full circle where people are going back to wanting to make sure that, you know, butcher shops are cutting whole animals.
Mm. When it comes to the judging, who's going to take the top spot? What are they actually going to be looking for?
Oh, it's a wide criteria. They want to know how you work as a team, how you communicate as a team, how clean your uniform is, if you conveyed your theme properly, if your tools are sharp and clean. They want to know if you have signs and everything. They're looking for innovation, for value adding and on the product. It's quite a judging process.
Did you ever imagine that you would be competing where the Sacramento Kings play at a big arena?
No, not at all.
Was it like that in Belfast when you went in 2018?
No, Belfast was cool, but it was right next to the Game of Thrones set and they were filming the last season. So it was in these tents at the Titanic Center, they called it. And it was two rounds of six, so there was 12 countries. And when we went there, I kept looking around going, yeah, I think we can pull this off at the Golden One and make it pretty cool.
Mm. Was that the first time you ever competed?
No, we had competed in Oakland at the Eat Real Festival and won down there.
What does it add to compete for something that has been a passion and profession of yours for decades?
Well, it's kind of weird because when I went to meat cutting school, it was very competitive, and so they would time you. And you would get money if you could break certain records. So I was taught speed and precision right off the get-go. Hmm. And then I've kind of had that mantra a little bit at Taylor's. You know, I get them trained, and I'm like, all right, let's start racing, you know, just to get you to pick up the speed sometimes. Like, for instance, this morning I had a guy call in sick, so I had to throw the counter together rather quickly.
That's some good practice for next week.
Exactly.
Danny Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Danny is the co-owner and butcher at Taylor's Market in Sacramento and will be leading Team USA at the World Butchers Challenge over Labor Day weekend at Golden One Center. There will be more than a dozen butchers competing from all over the world about 13 countries, right, Danny?
Correct.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. We'll be right back.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.